I don't think everyone's here. Okay, so this morning's Dhamma talk. So I've given lots of talks so far, and I always try and link today's talk with the last talk or something, so it can be a bit of a progression. And yesterday I talked about the meaning of will and doesn't belong to you. So I thought I'd just go a little bit a little bit further, and actually just do a kind of easy talk, because yesterday's talk about the will is sometimes quite confronting. I already mentioned to you in that talk that once one of the presidents of the Buddhist Fellowship, he had enough of the talks about good, bad, who knows, or talks about opening the door of your heart. The nice talks, he said, but can't you go into a really deep talk? So I gave a talk on what will actually is, and it's not yours. And basically it's a bit of a myth. And he told me afterwards, that was a very good talk, but don't do it again. And the reason was because he didn't sleep that night. It was just a bit too much for him. Because he could understand it, and it made a lot of sense to him, but it was a bit sort of hard from the first time. So this time I decided to give today a nice easy talk just on enlightenment. I think you should have seen that coming. So of course everybody wants to get enlightened, but that's like an oxymoron. If you want to be peaceful, you never are peaceful. So want is a big problem there. And from the want we get the sort of the doing. And so, this is one of the things which I was quite surprised about. When I became a monk, I left UK, and my plans were, I told my friends this. I said, look, I'm just going to go to Thailand to become a monk for a couple of years, become enlightened, and then come back and continue on with my career and get married and have a family. I even thought that at the time, that's how stupid I was. But then, that was all because, you read books, you never really practiced, never really understood what was going on. So, it became quite clear what enlightenment is not. And that's why sometimes you may ask, Ajahn Brahm, how can you tell someone's enlightened? The answer is you can't really that clearly. But you can certainly tell when they're not. And that's a pretty easy thing to do. There's many things which an enlightened being, a fully enlightened being, just cannot do. They cannot have lust, they cannot even have little desires, they can't have ill will, they cannot ever believe that there is a permanent self inside of them. This is one of the things I never said yesterday about the teaching of anatta. How many of you here are Kiwis from New Zealand? Yay, well done. Because one of the heroes of New Zealand in Cambridge was Professor Rutherford, the guy who split the atom. One of the nice things about going to a university like that in those old days, it had so much history behind it. There was this old lab, little rooms here, little rooms there, and this is where J.J. Thomson discovered the electron. This is where Rutherford split the atom. This is where someone else discovered quasars. It had like history. It was like thick with this idea of these little scientists in back corners of corridors and little rooms inventing all sorts of amazing stuff. And all they did was just very simple equipment. And when it came to the room where Rutherford split the atom, I always remember that and thinking, yes, Professor Rutherford split the atom and shown that the idea of an atom being a fundamental particle of physics, the thing from which everything else is built up of, was disproved. But then I also noticed the word atom. It comes from a Greek word, and it means indivisible, like a fundamental particle. You can't split it up. And so they never renamed it to something else. They kept it as the word atom because it was well known by then. But nevertheless, he proved the atom is not the essential particle of stuff. I mean, I also contemplated that Rutherford wasn't the first person to split the atom. 2,500 years earlier, the Buddha split the Atma. Because those two words are related. You know, that Greek is an Indo-Aryan language, so is English. And you know what the Atma is? That's the Sanskrit word for it, the Atta. In the Indian version of those stories, it's called Atma. Same meaning. It means like essential particle of life which cannot be divided, which is permanent, essential, be there all forever. And the Buddha saw through that thousands of years before Rutherford did. But I like the simile there, the simile of language, and the simile of we're always looking for a fundamental particle of ourselves, something which can go from life to life, something which is a part of us which cannot be created, cannot be destroyed, like an indivisible atom. And it's interesting, just the words are the same, just in different languages. But anyway, so I went off to Thailand thinking that I'm going to get fully enlightened, and once I got that out of the way, then I could carry on with my ordinary life. But you were very fortunate to meet someone like an Ajahn Chah, who'd have taught things in a totally different way. And the thing which impressed me was how he was very, very smart. And I thought with all my education I could be even smarter, but it was obvious that, and really obvious, he was much smarter. And so I stayed on as a monk. And it was about 4 years. When you're a young monk, there are many advantages. Those advantages, you don't have too much responsibility. And you can travel around and you can come here and listen to a talk when you're supposed to be Bodhidharma, as I once said. You do the work anyway another time. So it's nice when you're over at a young monk, you can actually do much more practice. And I remember my fourth year as a monk in the Rains Retreat, staying in this beautiful, well, it wasn't actually a beautiful monastery, it's just an ordinary forest monastery in the northeast. And because I had not many duties at all, you could actually spend a lot of time meditating. And of course, when you're focusing on the meditation, the mind gets deeper and deeper. It's like doing not a 9-day retreat for 9 days, it's like doing this for 3 months, really getting into the meditation. And of course, every now and again, you know, your meditation really hits a high spot, get really, really deep. You know, those where you go to the building site, it's a Friday and you get a big paycheck, that sort of thing. So anyway, I was meditating and my mind was going very well, nice and peaceful, a lot of bliss, focus still. And then usually, you know, you finish off about 9 or 10 o'clock and go to bed. But as I mentioned to you, if your mind is very peaceful, don't waste that opportunity. You can catch up on sleep in another time. If the mind feels really peaceful, clear, just go for it. Keep on going. And the mind enjoys that. You can sleep in later on. That's one of the reasons why we don't have the schedules here. We do have schedules, but I'm not going to check who's here and who's not here. And when we don't worry about the schedules, it means it gives you more freedom and looseness to be able to, if you're really going well in meditation, carry on. You don't have to worry about not getting up in the morning because you're too tired. You can sleep in the morning, or you're tired in the evening, take a rest, and then get up really early. I don't know if any of you have been up early enough, say 2 o'clock in the morning, and come in here. It's really peaceful. No one here. You have the place all to yourself. It's like really sort of quite special. So I love doing stuff like that, especially when I was a young monk. So that evening, my meditation was really nice, very clear. You know, the hindrances were getting smaller and smaller. Didn't want anything, no ill will. Sloth and torpor wasn't there. and restlessness. You were just nice and peaceful. And I was doing that walking meditation, which I often talk about. And in the walking meditation, remember, you start from one end, just the body length as what you watch in front of you, not looking to the left, not looking to the right, not looking up and down, just in front of you. And you walk naturally. Sometimes it gets slow because that's what happens when you start to calm down. But you don't do that by willpower. It's just what the body needs to do. So I was walking in the forest, in the path in the forest, just getting more and more peaceful. And this always happens. When you get really peaceful, then you start to get these great insights coming up. It's, you know, from that stillness, samadhi pachaya yathabhuti anudassanam. From stillness, you start to see things as they truly are. And so as I was walking, I was just being still, but all these incredible insights, answers, these very deep questions started coming up. And I started thinking, wow, wow. And it gets very fun when you get insights coming up, seeing things you've never seen before. You get a lot of joy with that, a lot of happiness. So I was having a great time on the walking path, getting more and more insights coming up. And of course, it was maybe 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night. Still, we had to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning in those monasteries in those days. But I didn't mind, I had plenty of energy. If I did go to bed, I probably wouldn't be able to sleep anyway. So anyway, I carried on meditating, and then more and more insights came. And then the big one came. Really big. Wow. That was it. And I really thought, there's another enlightened being has arisen in Thailand now. It was lovely being enlightened. You had all this energy, just no tiredness at all, no restlessness. Whatever you focused on, you could focus on and keep it there for years if you wanted to. That's what it felt like. Lots of energy and a great feeling. Oh, I never need to do anything anymore. You're enlightened. You're finished. Ah, wonderful. And then I went. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning, and I thought I should look after my body. So I went to my hut to stretch out, have a rest. No way you can go to sleep. It was just like stretching the body. And about 2:30, I might as well go to the hall. So I was in the hall. You know, usually when the bell rings for 3 o'clock in the morning, oh no. But I was just there in the hall already, meditating, and the bell was just so sweet. And when the monks sort of dragged their bodies inside the hall to start the chanting, you can hear them just shuffling and sitting down. And I was already sitting down perfectly straight, and the head monk rang the bell to start the morning chanting, Yosa. I'd never said Yosa. I said, Yosa Bhagawa Allah. I had so much energy, and I couldn't stop it. It was really powerful energy. And I really gave that chanting full power. And then after that, we would meditate, and many other monks would just be falling asleep. I was just dead straight. No sloth and torpor at all. And then afterwards, we cleaned up the hall, and we went on arms round. And when I went on arms round, I never told anybody that I'd just been enlightened. But what I did, every village lady or boy or grandpa who put rice in my bowl, when they put rice in my bowl, I zap them. You don't know how much good karma you're making today. And I went from my arms around just so blissed out. And then when I got back to the temple, usually in those monasteries, the food, I'm not just exaggerating, the food is disgusting. The usual food every day the same. You had a sticky rice and then a curry made of rotten fish curry. And it was rotten fish. They would catch the fish in the paddy fields the year before and they put them in these jars, not very hygienic. Any health inspector, they would die if they saw how these were kept. Because I remember just finding one of these bottles with the rotten fish in another monastery. It was left outside. They put a bit of plastic on the top to try and seal it, but the plastic breaks. And inside this jar of rotten fish, there's crawling with maggots. And the flies had got inside and laid their eggs, and it's crawling with maggots. And I picked it up to throw it away. And the headman of the village, he was supposed to be the most educated. The headman of the village saw me, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Look, this has been unsealed and the maggots have got in. I'm throwing it away." He said, "No, give it to me. That's extra protein." And that's what we had in our curry the next morning. We actually ate that stuff. I was a vegetarian before I became a monk. You couldn't be a vegetarian, there's nothing to eat in that part of Thailand. So that was, and it smelt as well. Stank. You kind of got used to it, but you know, not that much. So we had the pot of rotten fish curry as usual with the sticky rice. But that morning, the whole 90 days raised retreat, that was the only morning this happened. There was a second pot of curry. And that was actually, you know, from town. That was that kind of hygienic curry. And I didn't know where that came from. This is weird. But anyway, I thought to myself, maybe I know where it came from. Maybe the heavenly beings also want to celebrate a new enlightened being has just arrived in Thailand. That's honestly what I thought. And so I sat in line. I was number two monk there. And the head monk, you know, after giving all the blessings, he received the food. And you know, we already had our rice, but then you know, he was going to choose what he was going to put with the rice first. And he opened both pots up. He's a local man, a local monk. So he was used to the rotten fish curry. But he never took any of that. He looked at this new curry, which was more delicious. I wouldn't call it delicious, I would call it edible. While the other one was not. And he took this big whopping ladle full of that curry and put it into his bowl. And then another whopping ladle full, and another whopping ladle full of this curry. There's no one could eat that much. But never mind, there was plenty left for me, and I was number two. I can get my share soon. But then before he passed it to me, he took up the rotten fish curry saucepan, and he was saying, "Mern gun, loy, mern gun," which means it's all the same. It's all the same. And he proceeded to pour the rotten fish curry into the edible curry and mixed it all together. It's all the same. It's all the same. And I think, you know, if you were there, you'd have probably done the same as I thought. If it was all the same, why didn't you take yours first? You should have mixed it up together before you took yours. That's really unfair. You've destroyed the celebration of my... And I thought, uh-oh. Enlightened beings don't get upset and angry. And I realised from that I wasn't enlightened after all. And if ever you have that experience, that afterwards you don't care what you eat. I just slopped a bit of terrible curry, all mixed together, good curry and the bad curry in my bowl, and passed it down. I was very depressed all day. It is depressing. But what it taught me a great lesson is it's easy to think you are enlightened, but sometimes you've got to wait for a while and see if any of these defilements, these greed, hatred, delusion, and things like anger and wanting, to see whether they are still there, whether they've just been suppressed or whether they've really been sort of destroyed. And that takes a time sometimes. Sometimes you have to wait for months. But anyway, it was a nice lesson for me. I know there was one of the famous monasteries over in Sri Lanka. There was a story about these two temple boys. You know, that sometimes the temple boys are sent to the monasteries because they get well fed, they get looked after, and it's an opportunity to help, you know, good monks. So these were two temple boys in Sri Lanka. They were very good, very well behaved. And one day they did ask, well, you know, we're in the temple, we do have some free time. You know, can you teach us, you know, how to meditate? You know, we might as well, you're good teachers. So the head monk taught them basic meditation. And one of these boys was a natural at it. He started getting some very good meditation, very deep. And everyone was kind of excited. All the other monks were telling this story. They were excited that here's a young boy, you know, has made it to a monastery, got some instruction, and is really flourishing, getting some very deep meditations. And, you know, sometimes the word would get around what he'd experienced and how deep he was going in meditation, all the great insights he was getting, just as a young boy. And then it got so, so powerful that all the monks were waiting for the latest news of this prodigy of meditation and Dhamma. And soon the head monk announced, well, this young boy is enlightened, fully enlightened, an arahat. It's amazing. And everybody was so impressed. But then this young boy, he told the head monk he had a toothache. And so they said, well, the only thing to do is, you know, you don't have to worry about paying for anything. We'll send you to the dentist in town and he will sort of sort it out. And I think you probably have to have the tooth removed. And he said, what do you mean, have the tooth removed? How do you do that? Now, this was a simple boy. He didn't have any idea what dentists were. But I don't know if you're a young boy and see all the tools and equipment in dentists years ago. It's pretty scary for a young guy. Those little hooks with sharpened edges and pliers to pull things out. It's pretty scary. And so this young boy thought, maybe I don't want to go. They found out he was showing some fear. And that's another thing, enlightened beings do not have fear. Other people don't have fear too. I remember once when I was in Thailand, years after my fake enlightenment experience, there was many of those, in those days, that was in the 1980s, 80s? No, 1970s. Late 1970s, early 80s. If you saw the old buses which they had over there, those buses were so ill-kept. They were dirty, oily, and they're packed with people, as many as you could get on, and chickens and other things as well. And there was a series of accidents where these buses would catch fire. And one of my friends who was a monk was on one of those buses. And he had to escape and he had to leave his bowl, you know, actually inside the bus because he couldn't get it out fast enough. And so, you know, the bus company just replaced the bowl for him, got him a new one. But nevertheless, it was really dangerous. And many people had died. And the bus I was travelling in was a very old bus. And where they put the monks is in the front. The driver's on the left side. And the front seat, you know, facing the window, was where they put the monks. And there's a reason for that. Because I always feel that the monks have got such good karma that if you've got a couple of good monks in the front, they can't crash into somebody with a front-end collision because the monks will protect them. And I remember just some of these more modern buses in central Thailand. I remember going on one in Chonburi and it was taking us up to Bangkok. And as I got on the bus, you could see the bus driver smile. You don't have to pay. He put me in the front seat, and I realised why he was so happy, because there was a TV on the front of the bus, and the bus driver was watching the movie. And it was my job to protect the bus from collisions. That was really scary. He was watching, and I was, hey, and then he quickly looked, okay. And he'd avoid the truck coming the opposite direction. So, you know, he trusted me. It worked that time anyway. But it was scary for me. That's why they always like to put the monks in the front, protect the from collisions. And I did try that when I, one of the first times I went on Thai Airways. I was, you know, the economy class, and I said, well, look, you know what you do with me in the bus? You always put me in front to actually protect you from any accidents. So would you like to upgrade me to the... It didn't work, but it was worth a try. So anyway, where was I with this? Oh, yeah, in the bus. In the bus, and I was sitting there by the window, and there was a monk sitting next to me on the aisle, on the front. And then somebody shouted at the back, fire, fire! And the bus screeched to a halt. And as soon as it was stopped, the bus driver, he just climbed out the window. And everybody else, you know, rushed to get to the entrance so they could escape too. And even the monk sitting next to me, he was up there. We're not supposed to come into physical contact with members of the other gender. He didn't mind that rule, he was out of there. And I was just sitting there because I didn't know what was going on. Don't read newspapers, didn't see any radio or TV or anything. I didn't know what the danger was. They said it was a fire and many people had died, but I didn't know that. I just sat there, what's going on? And everybody else left, except there was one guy in the back and he was just checking the source of the smoke. And then he shouted out, it's only a cigarette, only a cigarette. It was safe. I hadn't left the bus. The bus driver had, everybody else had. And all the people, when they came in, they had to go past me. And they were saying, sad. They thought I was an arahat. I wasn't an arahat, I was just stupid. Being honest, it felt nice, I must admit. But anyhow, that's one of the problems, you know, that sometimes, why don't people feel fear? Sometimes it's stupidity. How about other times? Other times it's much more confidence. And this is actually quite strange. There's a few times and I think, what did I do that for? And there's one time when I was visiting my mother in London and I was going to give a talk that evening in the Sri Lankan temple. It's just walking distance. And I grew up in that area. I knew that area very well. And as I was walking down the street, I should have known better because it passes block of flats, apartments for poor people. And that's where there was a lot of like hoodlums, gangs, young people without jobs, without hope, who would do all sorts of terrible things. And as I was walking along this road, Acton Lane, if anybody knows that, and as I was walking down there, there was a group of youngsters congregating. And they didn't know really what they were going to do, just meet together and then just have some ideas and do some illegal business or something. And when they saw me coming towards them, bald head, brown robe, walking slowly towards them, they decided to try and have some fun. They started chanting, Buddha, 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 and staring at me. And the closer I got, the louder it became, and closer together the words, Buddha, 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 Buddha. And they were trying to scare me. A sensible monk would have turned around and gone the other way, or at least gone on the other side of the street. But there's something about me rebellious, I'm not going to be intimidated. So I walked straight towards them. Buddha, 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 Buddha. And there were some big guys there, many more of them than aware of me. So what would you do? As I got within about 5 meters of them, I raised my hands. I've never trained in Kung Fu in my life. But I did watch the TV series Kung Fu with David Carradine when I was young, before I became a monk. That's the only thing I knew about Kung Fu. So I put this forced kung fu pose on. They didn't know. I mean, they were just not very educated youngsters. And of course they stopped chanting. And I went right towards them and they moved apart and let me walk right through. They didn't risk a fight with a kung fu master. I looked like one. Okay, I had a bald head, brown robe. That was enough for them. And they never tested me. And sometimes, what the heck did I do that for? If one of them had attacked me, I'd been dead or in hospital or something. But that's the thing with fear. And one of the other times, there was... this was more interesting because I used to go and teach in the prison in Bunbury. And when I taught over there, I always had a free afternoon, get on the train at lunchtime and then stay overnight there and come back the following morning. I teach in the evening. And this day I was, what a nice place to meditate. I went to the beach in Bunbury. And it's a long way from the city centre, not a popular part of the beach. You know, quite a ways down south of the main centre. It's quiet there. You can sit down there quietly and just have a nice meditation. And on this occasion, I was sitting there quietly and I felt something fly past my ear and then hit the ground. And then felt hurt. No, I didn't feel anything, just heard another thing whish over my head. Someone was throwing stones at me. And then I just stayed there. I'm not going to move. My meditation's too important. Then a few more stones came past. And then somebody shouted out, "Get off our beach, Rajneeshi!" And then they threw another couple of stones. And I realised that there were such bad shots that one of them would hit me sooner or later, just by chance. So I stood up and turned around. And again, a sensible person would just walk away. I said, "I'm not going to do that." I walked towards them. They were no school kids, maybe 13, 14-year-olds. And as soon as I walked towards them, they all dropped their bundle of stones and ran away, except for one. And I went out to him and said, "Look, I'm not a Rajneeshi, I'm a Buddhist monk, but even if I was, there's no point to throw stones at people. That's not being very advanced at all, or very civilized, or very kind." And then he said, "Well, what are you doing as a Buddhist monk?" I said, "I was meditating, just minding my own business, being quiet." And then when I started talking to him about Buddhism and Dhamma, all the other ones came back, and we had this wonderful conversation about the Dhamma. It worked really well. Because I kind of just earned that little bit of respect by not being intimidated. But the time in almost the same part of the beach in Bunbury where I was intimidated, and I admit this, again, having a few hours, I sat down on the beach, a nice meditation for 2 hours. I was just sitting there nice and quietly, enjoying myself, getting nice and peaceful. And when I came out of my meditation, there was something strange. When I looked to my left, there was this young 17-year-old blonde in a bikini sitting right next to me. When I looked to my right, there was another 17-year-old brunette in a bikini, long hair, also sitting next to me by the beach. And straight away I thought, I hope there's no photographers. How am I going to explain this? And the reason I knew there were 17-year-olds, because they explained what they were doing. I never knew these things, but it was the last day of the last exams of the school year, the university entrance exams. I used to call it TAE or something. And they'd just done their last exams, and the school was just on the other side of the road to the beach. So they just finished all these years and study and then about to leave school and go to university or go somewhere. And they all decided to celebrate. Let's go down the beach, get in your bathers and just enjoy. Finish the exam. Yay! And two of these girls had already changed into their bikinis. And they saw this guy in a brown robe, bald head, sitting peacefully on the beach, and they were quite inspired. How can you do this? Who are you? So they actually sat either side of me, waiting for me to come out of meditation. They waited for about 20 minutes or 25 minutes, they said. And then afterwards, they asked me all these questions about meditation and stuff, which was quite nice. The only thing is, again, if there were those mobile phone cameras in those days, I'd be dead. How can you explain that? He said, oh, it's a nice story, Ajahn Brahm, but is that the truth? Ajahn Brahm with his two beautiful girls sitting next to him. It's really difficult being a monk sometimes. You've got a good mind. But anyway, that's like no fear. So anyway, enlightenment is to actually to see the Dhamma is not easy. And that's, you know, I try and make up all these stories, you know, what the Buddha said or what other people said, and just, you know, what you understand yourself. And to be enlightened, it's basically the ending of all wanting. Remember that story I said yesterday about the five kids playing the wishing game? And the one who won the wishing game was not the one who had an infinity of wishes, but the one who said, I wish I was so content, I never needed any more wishes ever again. The end of desire. The two freedoms which I mentioned at the end of that talk, which are powerful. The freedom of desire, which is what people with power want, to get what they want when they want it. When they're sick, they've got a cancer, they want to, you know, get rid of it. Want to have the power to get rid of it. When they have other difficulties in their life, they want the power to get rid of those. When they see other people in difficulty, they want the power to make sure that doesn't happen to them, or they can cure them, or feed them, and stop the terror, stop the war. All those desires, and some of them can be very noble desires. But people want power to have the freedom of desire, to be able to solve the problems of the world. And please remember, that was something which Mara offered the Buddha just before he was about to become enlightened. Don't become enlightened. Be what they called in those days wheel-turning monarchs. So powerful you can solve all the problems in the world. And the Buddha rejected it. There was something more than that. Anyway, what's the reason we have problems in this world? The reason we have problems in this world is to learn from. They're not punishments. Even when people talk about the law of karma and they say that I now have this difficulty, I keep not having any place to live or no money or whatever, is that a punishment? We don't do punishments in Buddhism. This is like a learning opportunity. And I don't say that glibly. I often notice, if you know what it's like to be poor, to be hungry, if you spent days and days without any food, you just can't pass by someone who's hungry. You just can't do it. You know what it feels like. And it's still there inside of you, the memory of those days of just not knowing where you're going to get the next meal, literally. And that means you will always be generous. Not to pay off bad karma, but it's a natural growing, a natural learning, a natural becoming wise. It's the emotional wisdom, and much of that emotional wisdom does grow out of pain. When you know what it's like to be in a bed suffering and suffering and suffering and there's no real hope for you. And of course you'll be kind when you see people in hospital. You will find the time to see them, to visit them. Even though it tires you out, it's not the point. Because you know what it feels like, really inside. So much of the difficulties which people face in life, don't call them punishments, opportunities, lessons to learn, to be able to grow as a human being, wiser and more compassionate and more selfless. So anyway, all of these things which we learn, eventually we see the meaning in acts of lots of pain. A good example of that, and please excuse me for the subject matter, but when I was teaching in Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur. The group I was teaching at, I still teach there, where I was teaching, they said they had a woman who had a very big traumatic problem and no one could be of any assistance to her. They tried many of the psychiatrists, psychologists, counsellors, which she could afford, but nothing worked. So they said, Ajahn Brahm, can you spend a few minutes with her? See if you can be of assistance. And because you know that the ordinary counselling, psychological techniques don't work, what you usually do is just to make your mind perfectly still, perfectly open, and just listen. And then see what comes out afterwards. So we're listening to her, and she trusted me, and she started to recount how she had been the victim of a very violent rape. It's gross to be able to hear, you know, what other people did to her. And when she stopped speaking, it was my turn to speak. You know what I said? I said to her, you were so lucky to be raped in that way. And if you were shocked, imagine what I felt. I was shocked what just came out of my mouth. But I trust what wisdom and compassion is. And I said, I think I understand what I've just said. I think I know its meaning too. I say that because I really believe, from what I've seen inside of you, that you are strong enough, wise enough, enough friends, to be able to find a way out of that terrible pit you've been thrown into. And I say you were lucky, because the meaning of that experience is that once you have found a way out, you'll be able to do something I'm never able to do. You'll be able to tell other women who have been abused in such a way, or a worse way, or a similar way, I know how you feel. I can't say that. I can imagine, but imagination's not the same as knowing. And once you can connect in the very deepest of levels to other people who have been raped in such a way, and you can connect with them and they trust you, then you'll be able to hold their hand and lead them gently along the same path which you walked to be free of that terrible thing. So that's why I said you were lucky. You can be a great benefit to the world. And it's amazing, just only when you're still, you're confident in your own compassion, can you say something as just outrageous as that. I was outraged, but it just came from deep within me. And I couldn't stop it. And it works. I don't say that if you ever meet someone who's been abused like that, or you've been abused like that yourself, you think, oh, Ajahn Brahm said I'm lucky. No. That was just person to person, just one person to one person, not something for everybody. But that's where you find that the wisdom which comes from emptiness and from trusting, from kindness. You don't want anything out of this, you're not judging anybody. You're just giving people what's really important. Whenever you've been traumatized, whenever you've been lost and lost everything and everything, the whole world is disappearing and vanishing and it's painful. If you can find meaning in it, a purpose, something which you can do with it, it changes the whole situation. Anyway, I was supposed to be talking about enlightenment, sorry. I've got another 15 minutes to go. So, for the enlightenment experience, it's basically when you are free of desires, rather than desires have freedom to control you. It's like you're in a jail all your life. always controlled by the will, which is mostly wanting. And that will just keeps you moving all the time. Have you ever known how, even here on this retreat, how hard is it to be still? Just to sit here and watch your breath. Why is that so difficult? It's not harming anyone, not hurting anybody. You got your breath and just watch it. Why is it that the mind wanders off, we have all these other thoughts, or we fall asleep, or we just don't want to meditate? There's so many desires which come up in our mind, which we believe in, which control us. Are you free from desires? Or do desires control you? Again, it's just that similar to that. I mentioned it yesterday. The photo of the Looney cartoon in front of the kitchen, the dining room. You know, the guy's saying to his mobile phone, he said, oh, this is my mobile phone, and the mobile phone replies, you are not my mobile phone, you are mine, says the mobile phone to its user, which is, you know, what do you own? If you own something, you should be able to turn it off. If owning something means you have power over it. But does you have power over the mobile phone, or does the mobile phone have power over you? Be honest. So anyway, after a while we realize that what we think we own, we don't. And that was one of the amazing teachings of the Anattalakkhana Sutta, which the Buddha gave. It was the first teaching which the Buddha gave, his second sermon, which led to others being enlightened, fully enlightened. When he said, look at, you know, what this body and mind really is. This body and mind of yours, and you start even with your body. It'd be wonderful if you can tell your body, look, we're meditating now, don't get an ache, don't get an itch, don't get sleepy, don't get sore, don't get tired. Can you do that? Why is it your body gets tired and starts to ache and start to itch at the most inappropriate times? Sometimes you start and get into deep meditation, my nose itches. So I scratch it and there's my meditation gone. Why does my body do that? Why can't I get sick? This is you who have jobs. Why can't I get sick on the work days and be healthy on the weekends? So your body is out of control. It doesn't do what you want. And that's just your body. Okay, you exercise, you eat well, but still the body gets sick. I remember just as a kid, I used to do so much yoga when I was young. And then there was this, it was on the British TV, I think, Yoga for Health or something. And I had these two people doing this yoga, this beautiful girl and this really fit young man. And they do these amazing postures. And when I became a monk, then I just was talking about to some others about this yoga program. I said, oh, whatever happened to that program? Is it still on TV? And he said, no. The guy walked off set one day and just dropped dead. Well, he can't drop dead. He was so fit and healthy. Even if you do yoga, even if you drink kombucha, you still die. And I thought, this is a bit unfair. So anyhow, you can't control your body. Number two, you know, your perceptions, your Vedana, your experience. Can you control your experience? That is why that simile, which I should have said yesterday, but about the will, is a simile about the old driverless bus. And I can tell when I started using this simile, and that was 32 years ago. This was way before Google started thinking about driverless cars and stuff. I should have patented this idea, and then we would never have to have any fundraisers ever again. But anyway, the driverless bus simile, it was just looking at how I was living my life and how you live your life. Now, the old idea of being in a bus, going on a journey somewhere, and that's your life. And why is it that in your life that sometimes you go have some terrible experiences, really nasty experiences, no fault of yours, and you think, like being in a bus, if your bus goes through the toxic waste dumps of life, you tell the bus driver, put your foot down on the accelerator, get out of here quickly, this is nasty, this is terrible. And what does your will, your bus driver, do? Slows down. Even parks in the ugliest, nastiest experiences of your life. You want it to get out of here quickly. And then when you go through these beautiful landscapes of waterfalls and kangaroos jumping and playing around, and it's a nice, warm, sunny day, and everything looks gorgeous, and you tell your bus driver, slow down, I want to enjoy this. Even park, let's spend some time here. And what does your bus driver will do? Puts foot hard on the accelerator and speeds out of here. Why do the good times not last very long? And the bad times last longer than they should. And your conclusion is, I've got a stupid bus driver. My will does not know how to drive a bus. It needs to have more smartness, more wisdom. It needs to know how to slow down when it's nice and peaceful and beneficial, and how to drive out very quickly if it's ugly. Like you're sick, you've got COVID, and it's really nasty. You want to get out as quick as possible, get it healed as soon as possible, so you can go and do nice work. So eventually you have to find the bus driver to teach it. And that's when you do this meditation practice. And then you find the bus driver's seat. You get out of your seat and go to the front of the bus where the bus driver sits. And where you find the bus driver's seat is in the second jhana. That is very clear. You're right there. And when you see that bus driver's seat, it gives you quite a strong shock. Your bus driver's seat is empty. There's no one there. The will has vanished, disappeared, not to be seen. That was an illusion of yours, taking something which was a conditioned process to be a thing, which was one of the most important parts of you. What happens when you see your bus driver's seat is empty? That thing which you thought was will is an illusion, like a mirage. What you do is you go back to your seat, you sit down, and you stop complaining. It hurts. Stop complaining. That's what a body does. It hurts. Sometimes you have wonderful times and they don't last as long. Welcome to life. That's what life is. You stop complaining. There's no one to complain to. There's no point in having any desires anymore. You're on this bus, totally out of control. Welcome to truth. You try to control it and it just makes it worse. You sit down and just relax. Then the driverless bus. When you realize all this wanting, all this craving, all this aspirations are counterproductive. You're free from desires. And that's a really good description of what enlightenment is. Free from all desires. Peace at last. Now some of you will think, that's crazy, Ajahn Brahm. That's okay. But what about the rest of you? Like the knower. Is that who you really are? I've only got 5 minutes. But one of my stories with Ajahn Chah, and I like ending on this story. One of my experiences with him, he started getting very sickly. So we found out by looking at the ancient texts that in Buddhism you are allowed to have a sauna in a monastery. They had saunas in the time of the Buddha. They were not invented in Sweden. They were in India. So anyway, when we found that out, we had this bright idea. Let's build a sauna for Ajahn Chah. It might assist with his health, but at the very least, he'd be coming to the Wat Nana Chat, where the Western monks were, where we're going to build that sauna, be coming there to have a sauna, and it worked so well. He would come once a week to have a sauna. But before he came to have his sauna, he'd give us a Dhamma talk. And some of Ajahn Chah's Dhamma talks were terrible. And I say that with greatest respect. And we'd listen to them all. They were boring. But because every now and again he'd give a really powerful one. It was worth it. And then this one particular afternoon, he gave us such a deeply powerful Dhamma talk. I was really inspired. And so there's many other monks went to the sauna of the Ajahn Chah to help him, to hand him his towel and stuff. And so I went to the back of the meditation hall in this Wat Nana Chat and crossed my legs and meditated. And of course, I've already told you, you never know when you cross your legs how deep your meditation's going to go. But that was a really deep one. And so I was there for 2 hours, just sitting on the concrete, not really worrying about time. But when I came out of the meditation, like quite often, you have so much gratitude for people who taught you how to access this great bliss and freedom and peace. And of course, that was gratitude for Ajahn Chah. So I got up from my seat, just really starry-eyed, and started walking towards the sauna. Just maybe I could meet Ajahn Chah on the way, or maybe he'd already finished. I was kind of fortunate because he had finished the sauna, but he was now walking back to the car to take him to Wat Pa Pong, where he lived, with another Thai layman, only just the two of them. And so I was walking along the path. We were going to cross. We couldn't miss each other. And then when I came close to him, just got off the side of the road to let him pass, then he looked at me. Pause. And my mind was just pretty free of hindrances at that time. So it's a weird thing. I don't mind sharing this. It's not my psychic power, it's his. You could feel him inside. Basically, that's how I perceived he was reading my mind. And for once, I did not mind at all that he was reading my mind. Please come in and check it out. I just had a lovely meditation. You look all over. It's like you tidied your room up before your mother comes and checks on you. It was a weird experience, though. You had to experience somebody reading your mind, and you know that was what was happening. And then, once he finished, he looked at me and said, Brahma Wangso. That's the full name. Brahma is just the shortened version. Brahma Wangso. Why? That was in Thai. Tamai. Why? He was obviously just really trying to teach me something, enlighten me. Why? And I replied, I don't know. That's a nice meditation, but still pretty stupid. I don't know. And the great thing about these teachers, another thing Ajahn Chah taught me, when you have a disciple who's really stupid, like me, he just burst out laughing. He thought it was so funny, he can go to great universities and still be so dumb. And he laughed and laughed and laughed. And then he stopped laughing. And he looked at me again. Brahma Wangso. If anyone asks you that question again, I'm going to tell you the answer. And I was really excited. I was going to get this personal teaching from this great monk on a very a very rare occasion. He's going to tell me how an enlightened one answers the question, why? And I was listening. So if anyone asks you that question again, the answer is, my me arai. My me arai. Which in Thai means, there's nothing. There's nothing. He looked at me with compassion and said, Brahma Wangsa, do you understand? And I said, yes. And he said, no, you don't. And he walked away. I remember that, feeling this combination of like privilege, inspiration, but also just embarrassment. And then he walked away. But it's a wonderful interchange. You know, they ask, why? What's the answer to that question? It's so simple. It's nothing. It's nothing. Do you understand? No, you don't. Okay, talk over. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. We will one day. Okay.